Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome along to the French Rugby Podcast with me, Tim Groves, former Scotland international Johnny Beattie and ex-France hooker Benjamin Kayser. We've got another great guest coming up on today's show, and he's a former teammate of yours, Benji, so hopefully you'll have some juicy stories for us. But we're recording slightly later in the week than we maybe planned, because you've been selling your chateau in France, haven't you, Benji? So are you a millionaire three times over now?
No, definitely not. I mean, I don't have the luxury of living on the Côte Basque. You know, Clermont is a humble, low to the ground town that just needs to get going. But listen, officially the worst, the kindest, but the worst movers in history, and made it particularly interesting. You know, all the cliches that we try to talk about, you know, about France and England, this and that. Well, my word, they were all the way up there. I mean, I'll sum it up to you that there was this guy, this weird looking, long haired guy who was rolling his cigarette in front of our house the day of the move, and he's and Andrew, my wife, was like, oh, listen, I think there's some weirdo there. So I'm there grabbing my golf club, you know, ready to go and kick some shit. And actually, he's like, oh, no, hello, no. I'm here to, because my wife renovates mirrors. I'm here to start packing the mirrors. And I'm looking at him like, wow, okay. So this guy, you know, is trying to smoke. Oh, I can't smoke inside the house. No, sorry. You know, it actually sort of bothers me just a tiny bit. And then he starts wrapping those mirrors and stuff, but he didn't wrap the feet. I said, yeah, but don't worry, when you put them in storage, they've got cardboard on the floor, you know, and they don't get, yeah, but how are they going to get to storage? It's like, well, in the van. Is there a cardboard van? No. It's like, you do the math, mate. He's like, oh, yeah, good point, good point. So it's long. So I just went back to finish all the little bits. I still have half the house left there. I mean, so I took the wine, 100%. I took my shirt.
The good stuff. Yeah,
priorities. I took my shirt. I took everything my wife wanted, obviously. But I mean, it was just legendary. Like a dressing room with three doors, empty, full. So it's not like they forgot like a box here and there. It's the doors that did not even open. So a long few days. But listen, that's done. And now I'm happy to be here.
Was your week better, Johnny?
Mine's been super quiet. So my wife Jen's getting to the end stages of pregnancy. So we're effectively on a self-imposed lockdown. So all travel, everything to games has kind of been kicked back. We've got maybe 3, 4, 5 weeks to go. So just waiting for the little bub to arrive, which will be good fun, quiet. Times ahead over Christmas, I imagine. But that's been it. So rugby now is on lockdown for me. It's all going to be watched on the TV, on the couch, instead of being up in Paris for Canal Plus, or even back with ITV, back for Scotland, Georgia was the plan, but now it's not going to happen. So quiet time, family time, which I'm looking forward to, and a crazy couple of months ahead.
Good stuff. Well, we'll get our guest on soon, but it's all been kicking off the pitch in France, hasn't it? So just give us the lowdown on what's been happening in terms of the kind of dispute between the LNR and the FFR about the availability of internationals for this autumn, if you can.
We'll speak about it with Scotty because it will fit perfectly, basically, of what his history, what happened and stuff. But so the French Federation elections just happened Saturday, and the results came in, and Bernard Laporte is still in place with a huge victory of 51.48%. And he got asked, you know, did you tremble? He's like, why would I even be scared? When the results are there for you, you know, it's fine. So it's all a bit of a show. But let's just say now there's just the start of the problem, because the league actually sued World Rugby and the Federation because they consider that is they pushed through this Auto Nations Cup with six French team games, including 1 week off in the middle. It's just too much to ask for the top 14 clubs to bear this heavy weight and burden of having to save world economy of rugby through international games, despite the fact that it's going to hit the top 14 clubs who, honestly, at the moment, they're coming out one after the other. 5,000 people in the stands was already complicated. 1,000 people, which is what is the case in most clubs, it means that by January, so it's like the day after tomorrow, they're going to have to find solutions because they won't be able to survive that way. So to be honest, French rugby is in jeopardy. We were mainly able to create this economy through rugby thanks to hospitality, to fan experience, to venues sort of economy that was generated around it. No more fans, no more venues makes it extremely complicated. On top of that, the Federation wants to save their ass, and they're basically blaming everything on the league. So the tension is sky high to the point where it's almost like a legal pursuit now. I think it's unheard of in the history that they're basically going through in front of courts and stuff. They had a few meetings of conciliation, I don't know how you call that, but that went nowhere. They said, okay, for 5 games, Federation said 6 games or 7 games, potentially because there's one in the middle. This international rugby starts by world rugby. Starts after that with the federations, and that's how it should be in my mind. But to be totally honest, when they created this Auto Nations Cup and they add a friendly game before the last Six Nations game, I just think that's pushing it. That's a bit harsh, you know? I mean, top 14 is already shaken for different reasons that we spoke about already. The reason why they're so tense economically is because they created this live or die situation. It's not that they don't want to be sustainable. They're paying maximum that they can, and they're spending as much as they can, and they created this fake economy that we spoke about that now is getting hit in the mouth by COVID. So it's an incredibly tough situation. Somebody's going to die. That's what worries me. Somebody's going to fall.
But that's the case everywhere. Going back to Bernie and Bernard Laporte, his election win kind of reminds me of Brexit. It's just going to divide people and keep, well, it's the same percentage as well. It's going to divide people and the story's going to keep going, but like ultimately, it's the one game added that's the difference and the sticking point. But realistically, the FFR, the French Federation, they normally have 4 internationals anyway in winter. But that's it. They're all at the point, like you said, Benji, you know, in January, something's going to start falling. But it's not just France. You look at UK, you look at Ireland, you look at the English clubs. I mean, there are a few big clubs in England already this close to going in the next month. There's a few huge names, huge clubs that are close to falling. And France is no different. Everybody's affected in the same way. The situation is dire for everybody. You've got Racing Metro, you had Jackie Lorenzetti came out, I think in March, and said, look, already we're losing 1.3 million a month in salaries and paying out. So it's not sustainable. Something has to change. But ultimately, the way the world is acting just now on a political level, everything is shut down, everything is forced. So everybody's got their hands tied. And now politically, it's like, political grab, what can we get financially? What can we grab? How can we grab power? But at the end of the day, the amount of money that they're spending on the legal wrangle that's going to come out of it is only going to generate more debt. So it's not helping anybody. The FFR, again, isn't a rich, even though it's a huge rugby nation, there isn't a lot of money in the FFR. They don't generate that much cash. So they need everything they can get. And the club's the exact same. So it's not nice to watch unfold. It's horrible, but it's the same everywhere right now, unfortunately.
But to give you, to your point, Johnny, just to give you an example of the reality in which the world is, and obviously the economy of rugby is, and the side bit that which is, we need to win an election, live or die. The budget that was presented by the FFR to basically, you know, I said, oh, the results speak for me, for Bernard Laporte. Apparently, and I'm saying, okay, apparently, because it's not a given fact, they based their budget on 5 international games of November with 80,000 people. They based their budget with Six Nations 2021 with 85,000 people in Stade de France every single game. So that's, not only is it being sort of blind, but it's also bluntly cheating. So that's the reality of, you still want to win your day-to-day battle. The big thing is that the massive battle that everybody is in, they should be aligning forces and trying to find the solutions together. Otherwise, like you said, somebody's going to get punched in the mouth. And it's a domino effect. Huh? Somebody's going to be hurt. And I would just hope and cross my fingers that at some point they're going to get a bit of smartness within them and actually find a solution together rather than just killing each other from side to side.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact,
you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, you mentioned it, Benji. Today's guest knows a thing or two about battles, disputes between the FFR, the LNR, French politics behind the scenes in rugby. And he's a former teammate of yours. So we couldn't get any stories really out of Sergio when we had him on. But hopefully Scott Spedding is gonna give us some juice. So let's get him on. He's also cancelled a round of golf, I understand, to be with us today. So that's commitment for you. So
that is commitment.
It's former Clermont and France fullback Scott Spedding. How are you, Scott?
Hey guys, good to see you.
To set the scene for us, you're retired now. How's retirement treating you? Where in the world are you?
Yeah, so I'm down in Ossegon, which is not too far from where Johnny is, down the south west coast. Fell in love with the place when I played in Bayonne down here. So enjoying life down here, family's happy, and really enjoying retirement, to be fair. I think the time was right for me to call it a day.
And Benji has just been selling his house, he's been telling us, in Clermont. But he tells us that where you live, property's a bit more expensive, Scott. So.
Mate, to be honest, he's got an absolute mansion. It's a beautiful spot that he's created with his lovely wife. An incredible spot they've got. I'm not that close to Scott because he hasn't invited me down to Osgore yet, which I'm a little bit hurt by. But Nick Abandonon's been there and he told me it's a spectacular spot. Beautiful little place.
Andrew's been down here, Benji, but you haven't, eh?
Exactly. Can you actually finish your sentence? Can you finish your sentence? You said that she was invited by your wife, because otherwise it sounds very weird. Huh?
No, but down here, obviously, I think we got in at the right time. You know, I think property has exploded down here. Like Benji said, with whole coronavirus thing, people are looking to get down to the coast and maybe live in more spots like these. So I think we got in at the right time and quite fortunate. But we're very happy down here. Little boy's happy. He joined rugby a couple of weeks ago with Johnny's little one. So they go play rugby on Saturday mornings and family's happy. And so playing a lot of golf.
Playing tomorrow, right?
Yeah, hopefully, if you're not podcasting, mate.
This is it. It's you today, mate. Golf tomorrow.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned that you and Johnny's sons are playing rugby together, so there's potentially a couple of future French internationals there. So we'll get on to your France career shortly. But just take us right back to the start. So obviously, you grew up in South Africa, played for the Sharks, South Africa under 21. So presumably, you grew up wanting to play for the Springboks, right?
Yeah, look, I was passionate about rugby from before I could play, like at extremely young age, 5, 6, 7. You know, I collected all the cards of the professional players back then. I loved watching rugby. My dad would take me to go watch. Back then, it was Transvaal, became the Lions, and we'd go watch Springbok games. So, look, I was taken by all rugby. Obviously, growing up in South Africa, the Springboks were obviously the team, especially around then. I think I was 9. I went to the World Cup final where they beat the All Blacks. My dad was very kind in organizing tickets, and he was able to take me and my brother. So that was an awesome experience. So I think I was taken by the rugby thing, and it turned out that, you know, from a young age that I played decently, and I was very fortunate to get scholarships to go to a decent school. So it quickly became that, look, I could make something out of this. But yeah, so obviously the way it panned out, once you get a bit older, it's just about looking for opportunities and trying to make it into any sort of team. But as a youngster, absolutely taken by South African rugby, by rugby in general, and just passionate about the sport from a very young age.
So how did that move come about, Scott? You talked about opportunities. How did the move to France come about for you after South African 21s and being part of the South African system?
So at a young age, I was pulled up into the Sharks senior side, but probably in hindsight was too early. You know, I didn't understand what it took to be a professional, or the sacrifices you need to make, the way you need to train and stuff like that. I was fortunate enough to play for South Africa in the 21, and we played the World Cup was in Clermont, and got back to South Africa. You know, opportunities had dried up a bit. I was playing in a Shark side, which was littered with Springboks at that stage. And Breve contacted me and said, look, they'd seen me play in that World Cup. There would be an opportunity, but I'm going to play with the juniors, you know, play with the Espoirs, it's like the under 21 or under 23 side in France. And opportunities were few and far between in South Africa. So I thought, you know, look, it's an opportunity. And I went over, and to be honest, I did not know how big rugby was in France until I got there. You know, you see these stadiums week in and week out, passion, fans and stuff. And quickly, my goals and sort of my ambitions were to make a career for myself, if possible, in France. And probably met the right guys at the right time here. You know, guys like Jamie Noon, a guy like Gerard Fosler, at Breve, and these guys quickly took me under my wing, very professional guys in the way they trained, the way they worked, and you know, I learned a lot from them, sort of got my life in order and started training properly and slowly performances changed and was able to start building a career for myself in Breve.
I remember you telling me that final, that was it, final, semi-final? Yeah, it was the final, I think, that you lost to France in Michelin for the under-21s World Cup, what, 2006, something like that? And you said you were impressed by the place, that you were sort of blown away by the facilities, the passion, like you said, the area and this and that. And at the back of your mind, you always had a thing about, listen, and then you started obviously following Clermont, sort of the way that they were playing and this and that. And you in the back of your mind, you're like, that's a place that I would love to play for. Breve, just to set the scene, is probably the biggest rivalry and the biggest enemies that you could possibly find. They hate our guts, like to the point they would spit at your face basically before a game and all that. But even him playing there, you mentioned Gerard Vosloo, who ended up playing for Clermont as well. So tell me if I'm wrong, but is it always in the back of your mind that you think, this could be a place for me, right? It could be a good place for my rugby.
I think Clermont sort of came on my radar when I got to France. We've seen Clermont play over the years, and just like the way they clean teams up. I mean, I've gone to play in Clermont with Breve or with Bayonne, and you know, you almost know you're going to get a hiding. You know, even the coaches know, you can see by the teams that they put out, you know, rather save our guys and send some young guys, because you're on a hiding to nothing. And just the way Clermont went about their rugby and the power that they showed and everything, it was almost like when you get the opportunity where Clermont comes along and asks you to go to the club, it's almost like a selection. Do you know what I'm saying? You get selected to go to Clermont. And I didn't ever think I would get the opportunity to go there, but it was definitely a club that I sort of aspired to play for. You know, I think a lot of guys would dream to go play for Clermont, especially back then, the teams that they had. So yeah, that's why when the opportunity did come, it was a massive move for me to get an opportunity to play for a club like that with the squads that they had and the facilities and everything that goes with it.
I want to go back a step. So before we get to Clermont, let's talk more about Breve, because obviously Clermont is here and Breve obviously is a different budget, different level of facilities. So as a young kid coming through the Sharks Academy, playing with top level Springboks, and then arriving at Breve, like you touched on guys like Jamie Noon, but when you arrived, what was Breve like in terms of a rugby culture, a work ethic, a place to play your rugby, compared to what you knew that then as a young South African bloke?
Well, for me, it was different. I came up and I played with the juniors, you know. I trained with the senior guys, but I played my first whole season, I played with the Espoirs. And It was really enjoyable. You played. We ended up winning the French Championship that year, and it was really enjoyable. It was probably, looking back, it was the best way that I could integrate into the team. I was one of the only foreigners in that side, so you know, quickly had to learn French. And you know, we went to, every Sunday afternoon. We'd go play in the most random places, and it was really a good experience for me.
And didn't you play 10? Didn't you play 10, Scotty?
Yeah, I played. I was a fly half back then. Yeah, so I was playing
the
10.
Biggest fly half in France.
That's to show you the quality of rugby at the spot. You can just dummy his way the whole time. Just get those big shoulders into those poor little Frenchies who were just barely out of high school. They got bullied by you, mate.
No, but it was good fun. And we still got a WhatsApp group with with those guys today. And it really was a great experience. And, you know, I remember celebrating that when we won the championship there, we celebrated for like a week with those boys, you know, and they, you know, and you just realize how important it was at young age groups for these guys, how important like winning a title was for them. And it really was a cool experience. But for me, the culture shock that I sort of got coming from South Africa, and I started playing a few games with the senior side, was the change room before the game. And Benji, you would know a few of the guys that Brive had back then. Brive had a really good side back then.
Mental.
They qualified for the Heineken Cup in the first or second year I was there. But I mean, guys like Arno Miller, Guillaume Rib, Pascal Didier, you know, like these guys were guys you'd rather have on your team than play against them. You know, they were out there to cause havoc. And I remember the first couple of games with the senior side, you know, just before the game, one of those three guys would shout and everyone into the showers, everyone. So like, I wasn't quite sure what's going on here. You know, in South Africa, change rooms are quite chilled before a game. Everyone sort of just cracks on with their thing. And we were playing a big relegation game against Lyon, and they started slapping guys all around the change room. And I remember Guillaume Rib went up to one of the Argentinian props and headbutted him, split his head open. But he split his head open, blood was pumping out. He went back and hit the knob in the shower that lets the water out. So both of them are drenched in water. One guy's pissing blood out his head. And now we've got to go out and play. And the guy couldn't start the game. Now he's on the bench getting stitched up before the game. And I was like taken aback by the noise. And these guys were shouting and slapping dudes. So that was, but you know, I suppose that was French rugby and the stories you hear of old school French rugby. It didn't work on me because I remember once I took quite a big slap from Arno Miller for the first.
He's 20 a big man,
game.
Eh?
For the first 20 minutes of the game, my ear was just ringing. completely put me off my game, and I was just trying to recover from my ear ringing the whole time. And but you know, those are special memories. You know, it's something that you've got to experience and. I really enjoyed my time in Brive. It was a good club for me. It was a good club for me to get opportunity to learn from guys like that. And I there were a few guys there that we crossed paths that really added massive value to me becoming a professional.
Just a quick one about Arno Miller. So he did his whole career basically in like Federal One, then Second Division. And then I had this team in Albi who absolutely killed everyone. And they got promoted to the top 14, a tiny little place near Castres. And they killed everyone because of that sort of warrior mentality and this and that. And then he ended up in the French team. Yeah. Marc Livremont picked him up. He had nothing to be doing in international rugby, to be fair. He pretty much said it. He's like, I barely power walk on a field. What am I going to do playing against, you know, Johnny Beattie and those fast fuckers? But he went then back to Brive and all that. And just for the little anecdote, he's the last time that I got punched in the face in a scrum. You know, that old school thing when you know that the lock sort of waxed the arm. The other guy who did it to me is Jimbo, but he didn't punch me. He just put his hand in my face and I couldn't hook because I couldn't see a thing. And I thought that was actually pretty smart, you know, for once. From Jimbo.
But you couldn't even get that right.
Yeah. I was going to say, he was trying to punch you.
Arno Miller, I'm telling you, told me he was going to punch me and he actually missed me a little bit. And the guy who was next to me is his hooker. He absolutely demolished this poor hooker called Michael Delpech. I can't remember his name. He went to Perpignan after that long-haired guy. Oh my word, he absolutely whacked him. So I had a bit of a mark, yeah, but his hooker was dead meat. So that was the type of guy that they were.
And there were a few of them. There were about five or six of them really known for that sort of stuff. And, you know, it was actually quite reassuring as a young guy. You know, we maybe didn't have towards the end of my time, we didn't have the biggest names or the most talented team or whatever, but we really had guys who who you'd rather have on your team going to play the big guys, because that we saw them do stuff and rattle opposition, especially when teams came to play us. You could see they were rattled coming to breathe because, you know, we had this pack. We had these guys that sort of created this intimidation. And I think we won a lot of games because of that, you know. And, yeah, I'd rather guys you'd play with than against them.
And around that time, Scotty, like, it was amazing that it worked for you and you enjoyed it. But there's obviously other guys that have been quite vocal after they've left that they really didn't enjoy it, didn't enjoy the club. Guys like Andy Goode, obviously fantastic players in the Premiership and for England, but for whatever reason, it didn't work for them. So can you put a finger on why it worked for you and why you loved it so much and why for other guys that arrived, why they didn't get it or why they couldn't buy in or what they didn't enjoy?
A set of balls, maybe. That might be the difference between the guys that you just mentioned. If Jamie Noon killed it in brief for years and Andy Goode did fuck all, I mean, that sums it up for you, mate.
Well, look, I wasn't, you know, when I came over, they had quite a big contingency of English guys. I think there was Andy Goode, there was Sean Perry, Steve Thompson, Ben Cohen, Ricky Flutie came over for a bit. Obviously, Jamie Noon was there. So there was quite a big English connection there. And obviously, I think maybe when a couple of games are lost, you know, fingers get pointed. I'm not sure. And maybe, you know, Andy bought in. Andy spoke decent French. You know, he really made an effort to speak French with the guys. He was well liked by all the by the squad. Obviously, he's good fun in a change room. And I think maybe with Andy, maybe the clash came in with the coach at the time. I think him and Ugo Mola didn't get on. Which was bizarre because Andy would go and play Six Nations for England. He would then come back to Brive and he wouldn't play. So I think Andy was getting maybe a bit frustrated, and then he got the opportunity to go to the Sharks for Super Rugby halfway through our season, and he took that opportunity to rather go play. So I think, you know, that left a sour taste in Andy's mouth, but he really was an appreciated guy there, and he really did make an effort. I think he, you know, now he only throws out the big swear words in French, but he did buy into the whole speaking French and made an effort.
And in terms of your next move, Scott, you moved from Brive down to Bayonne. So was that all motivated by wanting to be by the coast, the sun and the sand, or how did that come about?
Once again, like I can't say at that stage that I had a lot of clubs to choose from. You know, Bayonne, I was starting to play decent rugby towards my end of the time in Brive, thanks to Ugo Mola. Look, the current Toulouse coach, you know, he said to me, look, I'm going to play you, whether you play well or you play badly, you're going to play to the end of the season. And that sort of gave me the confidence. You know, I had a lot of doubt whether I was up for it, whether I had the... And I just played. And if I had a bad game, he stuck to his word. He kept me going. I was playing fly half. He then later moved me to fullback. And so that gave me confidence. And that last season, it sort of really started. It started coming together for me with my performances and stuff. And obviously, Bayonne then came along. And it was an opportunity to go there. They also had signed quite a few big stars at that stage. With the Rocathocos, the Phillips, Cedric Caymans was there, and so it was a step up for me to try keep going after where I need to try get to. You know, obviously later on the getting asked to go to Clermont was obviously those were the steps I needed to take to get to a certain position to put myself in a better position. But I can't say I had a lot of clubs looking for my services at that stage. So it was great to have one who was keen on me. And that probably was Bayonne where everything came together for me properly.
And it was a huge period for the club. I mean, Alan Athalou obviously put a lot of money in as the main sponsor. You touched on some of the guys. You had Chisholm there as well, Remy Martin, some huge names. But for whatever reason, it didn't quite go right on the field. You were one of the few shining lights in that group of people that we've just talked about. Can you put a finger on why it didn't go so well during that period at Bayonne? I think they would have expected much more success, but it turned out to be a relegation battle pretty much every year. Can you give us an insight as to why it didn't really function on the pitch for you guys?
Yeah, from I think this is just my opinion. Hey, from Athalou came along, he had a lot of money. He wanted stars there. So they went out and got big names. But I'm not so sure that there was much thought process behind the sort of the rugby aspect behind it. You know, it's all great and well, he wanted to have adverts for his brand and everything. And all these guys did add, but you needed to build a team around these guys. I like Joe Rocathoco is a perfect example of it. You know, you get Joe Rocathoco over, I mean, superstar. But he can't do it by himself. We all know rugby's played by, you need 14 guys around you, putting him in positions to finish his one-on-ones. end up throwing him the ball. He's got 12 oaks all over him. He's not going to be able to create magic from nothing. So I think there might have been a lack of foresight. Obviously, great getting these players, but how do we build around them? How do we create something? And obviously, takes time to work. You're playing against big teams. You're playing against Clermont. Toulouse, these guys, the machine's rolling already. And they were just too impatient with it. And I think Afellou got quite impatient. They got rid of a few guys. He wanted them to pull out and, you know, sort of left the club in a bit of a spiral, negative spiral. You know, now you've got to try to rebuild, find more sponsors. And, you know, in Bayonne, historically, has always had a lot of politics, which doesn't help because the club is really important to the town. And there's always a lot of politics involved. And so it sort of became a, you know, hiring and firing of coaches, hiring and firing of players. And there was just no stability at that stage, which was disappointing because we did have a good side and we were able in a couple of those seasons to pull it together and play really well, but just lacked a bit of stability.
And then you mentioned the big move to Clermont. Did Benji give you a warm welcome? And what were your first impressions of him?
Benji, even when I arrived in the French team and in Clermont, was extremely welcoming. He's one of the few, probably in Clermont, that goes out of his way to welcome guys. And I think that's maybe somewhere where Clermont could work on, you know, between the players. You know, it's either, you know, I sit at my table, you sit at yours. Whereas Benji's probably, you know, he's there. He makes sure people are welcome. Even Andrea, his wife, goes out of her way to make sure that the wives settle into like a bit of a friendship group and make sure that everyone's settled. So
she's still coming to make sure you're settled in Hossegor. She's still making the journey down, right? You've already said.
Yeah, she's just doing that. But yeah, no, I went to Clermont thinking I was going to touch heaps of ball, but we couldn't win a line out.
No, mate. To be fair. So you touched on it, Scotty. There was a time where he was playing for Bayonne and picked for the French team, and then the move arrived. So obviously, because there was heaps of guys from Clermont, and we got along well, so we chatted about that move a lot. But there's nothing better than being part of a club when there's a guy who's like, listen, I would die to go to Clermont. I'm dying to sign there because I want to. And at the time, we had Nick Abandonon playing fullback. We had Ice Toeva who could play fullback in the center. So there was big. It was a big challenge for Scott to, as a French international, to throw himself into the competition of full on amazing team. You know, so I love the attitude of, listen, I would just love to come and to give, because Scott doesn't tell you, but I think you're being incredibly humble. To be fair, you're always praising others. You're saying, you're speaking about others for their work ethic and stuff. You were like a workhorse off the field, who always blamed yourself before you blamed everybody else nonstop, probably too much. We spoke about it loads of times. It was probably your dying side. You're always putting heavy burden on yourself when, you know, it's a team thing. When the spirit is not there, spirit's not there. So it was really enjoyable to welcome you to a club where you wanted to give everything. You wanted to experience the full shebang. And I'm desperate to speak about it because it's important, because I've got two foreigners here who actually have a French passport. It's more than just buying into the culture. It's wanting to commit to the country, you know, and that's a whole different ballgame than wanting to come to play for a couple of years, not really adapt, but Andy Good, whatever, you know, just like not really be able, wanting to commit. So the way that it ended as well, it was a bit painful because you guys, well, you, Scotty, did go through the process of saying, my heart is half French, you know, it's more than just a day-to-day thing. It's more than where I live. It's part of my blood now.
Yeah. We're going to touch on the French citizenship, getting French citizenship. And that was never a rugby move for me to want to do that. You know, I had already been eligible to play for France 3 years prior to that. So it had nothing to do with trying to make myself. And I think that people thought maybe I was doing it to try to put myself in a spot to get selected for France. But I'd always made the decision that as soon as the time allowed me, that I was allowed to apply for citizenship, that I was going to do that, because I really did feel like this was now home for me. And I wanted to, after my rugby career, make France home as it is now, and also give that gift to my kids one day, that, you know, I can give them a French passport, which in today's world is a big thing. So it wasn't a rugby thing. I think some people thought that that's why I was going about it, but it wasn't. But yeah, that's the way it is. We, you know, everyone has their opinions on things. But No, and I really did enjoy my time in Claremont. You touched on Nick. You know, that was also, it was a big thing made about me and Nick fighting it out for the same position. The strange thing is, me and Nick never really saw it like that. Obviously, we became friends immediately. We still are really good friends today. He comes and visits down here, you know, and we sort of just left it up. The coach is going to make his decision, and whoever he goes with, we'll go with. And it was just always like that. I mean, some guys can't seem to get on with guys in their position, or sort of seem to have beef with guys in their position. And it was really weird because such a big thing was being made about me and Nick playing the same position, whereas we just sort of cracked on, and it actually helped us getting some time off and being able to share the position.
I was going to say, it's impossible to play every game in top 14. Like, you need to have shared position, competition, decent people to compete with. But I mean, what a luxury to have you two guys as your two fullbacks at Clermont. You were really, really lucky as a team to have you both.
It would have been fine if it was just me and Nick. Then all of a sudden, we thought we had this all worked out, me and Nick sharing the game time, and this is going to be fantastic, play half the season, great. Next thing, they find medical joker Ice Tuiava, who comes along. And absolutely, honestly, one of the most skillful players you'll find. Like, you can't even argue to the coach to say, well, I'm not playing. You know, the guy, he's so classy. And then he ended up becoming probably the first choice fullback. And me and Nick sort of found ourselves, you know, fighting it out for second spot between us. So it really became where we were in a position where we had three international fullbacks in that squad, where probably a squad only needs one international fullback and maybe someone who can cover a bit. So it was probably overloaded at the fullback position at that stage. But I mean, even with us, I mean, he's such a classy guy as well that it was very easy to accept not playing with guys like that ahead of you.
Scott, going back again to your citizenship, I know that you really enjoyed the process of going through and going up and getting your passport, but they obviously as well, they made a bit of a case of you and they had a ceremony for you in Bayonne. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that ceremony and how it went.
Yeah, so you get awarded the citizenship, and then quite a few months later, they have a ceremony where you go over and, you know, you hand over your visas, whatever, and they award you your papers and everything, and it's a standard thing. All the people that have been awarded it, you know, go to the ceremony. And I had obviously just recently played for France, so there was quite a lot of press at this ceremony. And did the ceremony. They obviously go over the values of France and everything, hand your papers over. And then I was sitting with Rob Linder at the time, another South African who played for Bayonne, who'd also done the process. And all the press was there, and at the end, you've got to stand up and sing the national anthem. So I thought, you know what? I just played for France. I know the national anthem now. I'm going to show these guys that I can give it. So started singing, got through the first verse, and, you know, thinking, you know, smashed it. But little did I know that the official version has three verses. The one we sing in the rugby is only the first verse in the chorus, and then it ends. And so here I was, and I didn't know what was cutting, and I was trying to like mumble through the rest of the thing. I sort of went to my shell, was trying to get to the back of the crowd with all these cameras, but I quickly realized that I probably made a bit of a fool of myself that day.
I love it. It's amazing.
And Scott, you mentioned that the citizenship was not connected at all to international rugby, but you said there you made your debut. And I remember at the time, there was a big thing about how emotional you were. So just talk us through kind of how it worked, getting that call, like what you felt like at the time, and then making your debut.
Yeah, so there's actually a bit of a story behind that, which I've never shared with anyone. Probably no one's really asked, but...
We have now, Scott. Tell us.
So what happened was we were playing Clermont on the Saturday night. I think it was a very late game. It was a 8:45 game on the Saturday night. I finished captain's run on the Friday afternoon, went home, and I was busy having my pre-game barbecue or bra, you know, that I always used to do the night before a game, and I was in my apartment then. And while I was outside there, I got a phone call, a random number, and it was onto the phone. He said, "Hello, Scott, it's Serge Blanco. Where are you now?" So I was like, I wasn't sure if it was a joke or anyways, he said, I'm coming to your place in 15 minutes. So I was like, jeez, okay, quickly trying to tidy up the place, picking up my laundry.
Put another steak on the barbecue.
Yeah, he just heard you're having a barbecue, man.
And what? He arrived 15 minutes later and came up to my apartment. And I was like, I'm like, this is like way surreal for me now. I've got Serge Blanco sitting on my couch. My steak's still burning outside. And you know, I wasn't quite sure what he was there for. You know, I'd just recently been invited to the French Barbarians. I thought maybe, I know he's obviously heavily involved in that. Maybe it was to do that. I don't know if he was recruit me to go to Biarritz. And he said, look, there's been an injury in the French team. Brice Doulin has hurt himself. It hasn't been announced yet. It'll come out tomorrow. But he wanted to find out from my side what if I wanted to play for France, and that I'm probably going to get selected the following evening. But he said, it's not sure. It's not sure yet. And we need to see how your game goes. So he left me with that on a Friday night.
Pressure,
yeah.
And he left me with that on a Friday night. And he said, don't tell anyone. Don't even tell your parents, you know. Let's see tomorrow night. So he left me with that. So obviously, a lot of emotions going. Obviously, phoned my dad. Like, what do I do now? This is what's just happened. The next day, we went to the hotel. Long day in the hotel. And obviously, news starts filtering out all over social media and all the news things that Doulin is injured and who's going to be the backup fullback. Obviously, my name's being thrown around in there. I've got all my teammates giving me the big, you know, you're going to get called up. They're singing the national anthem and then we're eating lunch and folks all having a go. But I was struggling with the emotion. It was so emotional to try to keep this all in. I was struggling to concentrate on my game. We had a massive game that evening. So I actually ended up calling Joe Rokothoko and just asking him, can we just go have a chat outside? You know, Joe's a very clear thinker. You know, he's very realistic about things. And he just helped put things into order for me. He just said, look, you've got a big game this evening. The only thing you can control now is your game. So whether you play well or badly, the selection is going to happen. You get chosen or not, whatever. But all you can do now is control how you play. And, you know, it was emotional. I think I cried a bit with Joe that afternoon outside there. Anyways, went to the game. We had a decent game. I got charged down the first 2 minutes, which obviously didn't help my confidence, but I was able to rebuild the game. Had a decent game. We beat Clermont. And went up into the change room, and I was just like, it was so emotional. I didn't know what was happening. Was it going to happen? Maybe I got charged down. Maybe they're not going to approve of that. You know, Benji says I always think about the negatives, and I do. And was thinking about all the mistakes I made. Anyways, I needed to go to the toilet, and in Bayonne, the toilets are outside of the change room. And as I walked out, I bumped into Patrice Legiske. And he looked at me, and he just said, I've got a plane ticket for you to come to camp. And I suppose it was just the buildup of emotion. It was the anticipation. I had 2 days of emotion inside me, and it just sort of came out. I didn't realize there was a camera there. I asked him if could I please go back into the change room. Went back into the change room, and I didn't realize how viral the thing had gone until the next day. You know, I obviously had to go home and pack my bags and quickly get ready. We're leaving 6 a.m. to go to Paris. And but yeah, in the end, people still talk to me about it today. You know, people stop me and chat to me about, you know, it's probably the most common thing people speak to me about. And but it was a blessing in disguise, because I think a lot more French people easily accepted me to play for France because they saw what it meant to me. So look, it's something that obviously still it was a great, great moment to get that. But yeah, there was a bit of a buildup of emotion getting to that point.
That's an amazing story. And so just talk to us about how you then integrated into the squad. Because you mentioned when you came into the Clermont side, maybe obviously Benji was very friendly, but some others weren't. So what was it like going into that France camp, and how were you welcomed as someone who obviously wasn't born in France, but everyone had seen that video and seen how emotional you were and how you obviously felt French and you wanted to play for France?
Going to French camp was, I was very, I was nervous. Eh? There's no, like, I'm coming from Bayonne. We were two guys from Bayonne that got selected. The other one was Charles Olivon, who's now the French captain. But, you know, he was a 19 or 20 at the time. He didn't know anyone up there, and he didn't have any caps. And I didn't know anyone up there. I'd only played against all these guys. You know, it's a big Clermont contingency, Toulon, and I think it was Racing at the time. Big groups of players from one club. So it was difficult for me going up there, not having teammates around me. You know, it was a lot easier later on when I would go to French camp and I'd have 8 or 9 Clermont guys with me. But I went up as a bit of a loner, But yeah, I was very fortunate to have guys like Benji and other guys that went out of the way. A guy like Yannick Nyanga is always very friendly, always goes out of his way to help guys integrate. So there were a few guys that, that obviously made efforts and then quickly became part of the team and stuff. And obviously, difficult period for French rugby, but also we had some wins and we had some good moments. And, you know, it was a fantastic experience for me to be part of a French side and different French sides, which was fantastic.
You have to remember that Philippe Saint-André with Patrice Lagisquet and Yannick Bru, they were the three coaches helped by Serge Blanco at the time. And they were picking a lot of foreigners because they were not listed. They were like, listen, the results are just not there. If the guy wants to play for the French team and he's the best in his position, then stuff the rest. Let's just go. So they picked Rory Cocotte and they picked Anthony Classen. But I'm not sure he was French yet at that time. And Noah Nakatasi, you know, that they just started big. So every time there was somebody's names was mentioned, Winnie Antonio. You know, every time there was somebody's name was mentioned, it was, it's just another foreigner. But I think what Scotty did genuinely, because obviously it wasn't rehearsed or whatever, even though if you want to get Serge Blanco to your flat, just put a little steak on the barbie, mate. He'll smell it from a mile or two away and he'll be there. And I know Scotty's barbecuing skills and I would run as well for them. So it's only fair to say that you sort of, you got him in there, but that's, mate, you got to do what you got to do. But to be fair, his reaction, I know from a fact that the typical Frenchman will take the piss out of Scotty. You've been crying. But in their heart, they loved it. They loved it because you show passion, you show that you care, you show that you're just a general human being. That's the Latin side of French. We are full of emotions. It can be good, it can be bad. So when Scotty does it, you're like, there's more to that. It means a lot to him. Then if it means that much, then please come on board.
No, I think it definitely, like you said, there was a bit of a stigma at that stage with foreign guys getting selected for France. And I think it definitely did break that. It helped break that ice of that. And people were a lot more listening. Yeah, there's more to this. It's not just a foreign guy coming to play. There's a lot of sacrifice that's got in. And like I say, I get stopped by people often when they're chatting. And probably the most common thing they speak to me about is that video and how they were moved by that. And so that, you know, if it did help in people opening their perspectives a little bit, then I'm very grateful for that.
And talk to us about, you mentioned Philippe Saint-André and he was the coach at the time that you were playing under. And then obviously the 2015 World Cup and how it ended in the quarterfinal. So there were some good times, but it didn't end very well. So talk to us about what it was like playing under Philippe and then how it all ended at the end of that World Cup.
Well, look, Philippe's he's a very nice guy. He was always very, very welcoming and very nice to me. He treated me and my family when they came over fantastically. I came in at the end of his last year of his 4 years. And like Benji said, I think he was looking for solutions before the World Cup in bringing a few foreign guys or new guys in before the World Cup. I think he was under extreme amount of pressure by that stage. I think the team had lost confidence.
100%.
It wasn't an easy environment, you know. I think also what they try to do, which rightfully so, they try to save the 4 year tenure by having a big World Cup. If you could have a big World Cup, we can sort of forget almost what happened in 2011. Although it wasn't as obviously they had a lot more success, and we got beasted in that we had Benji. We got beasted in that 2 months leading up to the World Cup. I mean, we were extremely fit, but I probably think we were overcooked going into that. Guys were probably mentally and physically drained getting to the World Cup. And then, we were up against it. Everyone was hoping for some sort of big surprise or a bit of a miracle or whatever. But if you look at the 4 years, you know, realistically, other than a miracle, like that wasn't going to happen, you know. But everyone, because of what's happened between France and the All Blacks in the past, the rest of the world were hoping for some sort of piece of magic here. It just didn't pan out that way, and it was an extremely, extremely tough way to end that World Cup. And also something that was followed, I suppose, followed me and Benji around a bit, being part of that. It was a tough pull to swallow. I think the whole world was watching that game, hoping for a repeat of a classic France All Black game, and very disappointing to be on the receiving end of of a Harding in front of such a big audience and such a big occasion.
It was a sad.
It was, but even for me, watching as a Scot, watching you guys and seeing how much rugby means to this country, watching you guys, I was sad for you and sad for rugby fans. It looked like it was really hard and tedious to go through and to play. So what was the question to both of you, like, doesn't matter who goes first, but what was it like in terms of the environment around you? Because you knew it wasn't easy. The French press is really difficult. They were killing you every week. What was that like to live through as a team, to try and perform with that hanging over you, both as a team and as individuals?
I think for the French team at the time was the result of the one thing that we've been speaking a lot on this podcast is the fight between the clubs and the federation. They were just clearly not working together. It was, and you're sitting there, like in French you say, le cul entre deux chaises, your ass is between two chairs. It's literally what it is. Like you don't know who you're playing for. So we were fanatics of playing for Clermont. But every time you're talking about the 2015 World Cup, we did two finals that year with Clermont. We lost the Champions Cup finals to Toulon, and we lost the top 14 final against Stade Français. They gave us 2.5 weeks off. And then the first day I'm there on the BP. Mentally, we were absolutely drained. We spent hours on that freaking watt bike that I want to chuck outside the window now, because so it makes me want to think of horror stories. And honestly, we had a sad World Cup. We peaked after 4 weeks when we did a court session, and Marcoussi and everybody went on the piss massively. And we bollocked the coaches. And to be fair, Philippe is a good dude for that. He will accept a challenge. He will accept that you take the piss out of him and all that. And we peaked then. After that, I don't know what you think, Scotty, but it was just dull. It was sad. We don't even know if we were in England or not for the World Cup. We would stay in the Marriott in Heathrow before to play in Twickenham. Like, you're not even in London. We stayed in the Vale Resort outside Cardiff. You know that training Glamorgan. Center, whatever. Beautiful place, but it's freaking an hour away from Cardiff. Like, we could have been anywhere in the world. It was just dull, sad, hotel room, training, whatever. It was honestly, it was like a terrible memory for me.
I think, like what I said, I think we were. I think there was a general sense of just fatigue. You know, I think, like Benji said, the large majority of the group either came from Clermont or Toulon. These guys had just had massive seasons, massive top 14 and Heineken Cup or Champions Cup seasons with their club. They come and do a massive two-month preseason. And I think other teams arriving at that World Cup arrive there with, you know, this is excitement. They're now part of the World Cup. There's this buzz around you in the center of town. You can feel this. It's just a buildup of emotion leading into these games, whereas I feel like the French side going into it was just flat. You know, the guys were, even though obviously you want to get up for it, you want, your emotions are there, but you know, the mind and the body just struggles to get up to the same level as the Irish, let's say, who've just completely focused on this, or the All Blacks, you know, put all the emphasis on getting ready for these games. And I find that disappointing. And I really realized how bad it actually was when I went to Clermont, because then I was in the French side. And so you'd play big top 14 games, big championship, Champions Cup games, and then you've got to go play international, a big six to eight weeks with the Six Nations, and come back and get straight back into it. Whereas probably you'd be better off playing for a club like Bayonne if you were an automatic selection for France, or a smaller club where you could play the European Cup and you could sit out those games, and, you know, some top 14 games where the coaches, you know, maybe going to give some other guys a chance because maybe not going to go win. You get a bit of a rest. But when you're playing for these big clubs, and obviously that's where you want to be playing as a player, it becomes very difficult for the guys to be on the same level as other nations. And I think that's where, honestly, now that would be my biggest, the biggest, if French rugby can just sort that out, it would really go a long way, because they're really not putting the guys in the best position to perform at that level.
You mentioned the quarterfinal that we lost 60-12 against New Zealand, I think, the World Cup 2015. Ask Scotty, the night before the game, we went through the playbook or whatever, and we had a scrum move. Tell me you remember that one, Scotty. We had a scrum move that's like, you know, the 8 picks up, backs to the 6, whatever it is. You know that one that everybody does, and because the 9's going to follow, blah, 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 blah. And they're like showing this. See, this is going to work. This is going to work. Yannick Nyonga just raises his hands like, Philippe, mate, I think the ABs, I've got a yellow card, no? There's like the number 6 is missing. And they're like, he's there like looking at the screen.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you're right. But it'll still work. It'll still work. You know, it's not a problem. So you're basically basing your the whole strategy of a freaking World Cup quarterfinal, it's going to be on the fact that if the number six sort of happens to have a yellow card, then that play will work. That's how far we were from reality at the time. So yes, there's the Federation League hating each other, like Scotty said, the emotional drain, but we were also not connected with the reality of modern rugby. We were miles away.
And what was disappointing, like I mentioned, was the whole world was really getting for this game, and everyone was getting up for it, and sort of, yeah, if you look back on it, like it actually really was. You can't compare the two sides at that stage. Like it really, unless you really was a miracle that happened. But you know, it was disappointing. You know, it was very disappointing. And then to end on that note, obviously, I think the guys sort of just, it was bad memory. But I suppose it's one you got to take with, eh? The good and the bad. But yeah, every 4 years they show the highlights of that game. So,
well, it's no consolation after hearing your sad recollections of that story. But it might have been for some of the French fans that it went even worse for England than it did for you guys. So
there you go.
And then after that, obviously, you know, Guy Neves came in, and you were a regular under him as well. But from the outside, it was very much billed as, you know, he's done everything in club rugby, this amazing coach, what he's done at Toulouse. But he seemed to struggle at international rugby as well. So, I mean, you've talked us through a bit of the, you know, the clashes behind the scenes that makes it difficult for coaches. But how was your time playing under him?
Yeah, well, he obviously came in and he had to pick it up from quite low, but just after that All Black loss, you know, everyone, the French team was at quite a low. So he obviously needed some time to get the team to where he needed to. It started off all right. He picked quite a lot of young guys, a few older guys, which I was lucky to be part of. And I think he was on the right track. And then obviously we know that I think he's a guy that needs to be in control completely. You know, if he's going to have, he works with these players, he tries to play little mental games with them. So he needs to be the boss as he was in Toulouse. There was obviously the change of presidency and then all the press who got on the bandwagon of, is he going to get fired by Laporte? And there was this big, big talking point, which, and then obviously Laporte was there, and you could almost feel that, you know, there's now a battle of egos between the two bosses. You know, you could see if Bernard came to talk to us, then, you know, you could see by Guy's reaction that he wasn't respecting it all, but vice versa. And I just found that for me, that was like a bit of a moment for me that I was just so disappointed in French rugby at that moment, because you've got probably two of the most celebrated coaches in France. Two guys who have wealth of knowledge on French rugby. And if there was ever a time for two guys just to put their egos aside, to sit down and work together on the same page and say, listen, yeah, this is how we're going to sort it out. You couldn't ask for two bigger names or two more experience from these two guys. And they just ended up, obviously, it ended in flames with Laporte getting fired. There was also the, you know, the story of Laporte giving Guy an ultimatum of how many games he had to win, and it was just it was so disappointing. You know, that was probably the right time, and they probably had enough authority, power to go speak to the clubs. And you know, those two guys, if they worked together, would be able to probably have an influence on changing the system, but just incapable of putting their egos aside and doing what's best for French rugby. And I think that's where French rugby is at the moment, is that it's a battle of egos and prides, instead of really, let's make the right decisions now for French rugby. And that's just, it was extremely disappointing to see how that whole, those two ended his tenure ended with the French team.
Obviously, we've touched on it, but you had your own kind of disputes behind the scenes. Despite being a France international, you weren't given JIF status. And you were sort of heavily affected by the change in the rules and what was happening sort of behind the scenes towards the end of your career. So can you just talk us through what happened at the time and how it kind of developed into a sort of a legal dispute with the LNR and going to the Supreme Court and things like that?
So look, I had actually never questioned that I wasn't JIF. You know, I had JIF, for the English listeners, is obviously a player that's gone through an academy in France, counts as a local player in a quota system. Yeah. I'd never actually questioned that. You know, I understood it. I was South African born. I've come to France, and I knew I was extremely privileged to be playing for France. It came about, my agent got hold of me one day, said he'd spoken to an attorney who had had previous non-GIFs statuses changed to GIF. There were a few Georgians that were able to change their statuses in Montpellier, and he really feels that they've got a case for me to change my status, and he's going to, you know, speak to the Federation. So, look, obviously, you know, that getting brought to me, obviously you're going to want to do that. A GIF player is obviously a lot more attractive to a club and a lot more valuable to a club than a non-GIF player. So, you know, it made sense to me. I was playing for France and had the citizenship. And plus, I had been in academy just not long enough. So it all made sense. And the sort of, you know, I was in the French side at the moment, and they spoke to me at Marcosi at the time. They're like, look, you should follow the process and you know, we should try to get you this status. So I was like, of course, it's a no-brainer. Quickly, I understood that this was a very political environment that I was stepping into. You know, the league needed to protect their rule tooth and nail. And I very quickly found that all the guys that had supported me in the beginning it was just me and my attorney left. You know, even my agent sort of distanced himself from me because, you know, I think the league had put a lot of pressure on guys not to meddle in this, you know. And but it also took a whole dimension in the media that I now found myself in a position, one that I didn't really ask for and I didn't really want to be in. You know, like Benji said, I don't really want to be in the media, especially for anything negative and stuff like that. And I found myself caught up in this thing. Wherever I went, people were talking to me about it. The only one positive I had is that everyone sort of felt it from my side. I really felt that there was a strong support for me, saying, "Look, this isn't correct." So it was a bit of a dark time for me. I won't lie; it was I was in a big fight. And the league took it extremely important. I remember going up to the Supreme Court, just me and my attorney, because I'd lost everyone else. And I think the league walked in with a legal team of like 10 guys. You know, they were with the biggest guys. They were prepared for it. We were on a hiding to nothing. We were supposed to go to European courts, but I think at that stage, you know, I had lost all sort of motivation to keep going, to keep following this route. So it was disappointing. It was disappointing for that to be played out in the media the way it was. I didn't want to be seen as someone who took what I'd been given in France, you know, as like a bit of a spoiled brat. Now I'm trying to get more out of it. And I was worried that that's how it would come off. But my argument was more that, as much as I'm all for there must be a system to protect the young French guys, I'm the first guy that there has to be. These guys need to be getting opportunities. We cannot be having clubs with aligning 15 foreigners and the young guys aren't getting opportunity. Where I found that the rules were being bent was, I was playing for France and I'd play against Fiji and there would be four or five GIF guys playing for Fiji, but I'm playing for France. And so I'm becoming less attractive for a club. Because one, I'm away with France for quite a long period of the season. Plus, I don't count as GIF when I go back to the club. And I just felt that it was actually becoming a negative for me. It was becoming harder and harder to, and the clubs were telling me that, look, you're not attractive to us to take you. And so that was more, the rule in essence is good, but it's just been totally bent by clubs that it's actually, I think the year that I did that, there were 45 guys, 45 players in top 14 and Pro De Deux who were GIF, who were protected by the French quota system, but played for other countries. And I felt, you know, that is wrong. 40, that's over two, you know, you've got two teams there of guys that aren't eligible to play for France, but they're protected by the quota system. I'm playing for France and I'm not protected by the quota system. And I just felt that it was a bit warped, the whole rule, even though I understood why there needed to be a rule in place.
It is work, but it's falling into the political. It's because of the system that we have here in France with the FFR and LNR going at it constantly. And I heard as well, I heard that through the process, it came down to a vote and you essentially been guided through the process by the FFR and they backed you. But then ultimately it came down to vote in the end and the deciding vote was the FFR. And if I understand correctly, they voted against you. So they ended up having the casting vote and it was them that blocked you from becoming GIF after starting you and leading you down this process. Is that fair?
Yeah, well, that's also where I decided to drop this whole thing. You know, I understood now that it's taken another course here. When the FFR voted against it, because what happened was I went to the Olympic Committee and they voted in my favor. They said, look, if this goes to European courts, that, you know, he's got a strong case, he's a French citizenship, you can't be It can't be difficult for him. You can't put have rules in place that's going to make it difficult for him to find work as a French citizen. And they voted in my favor. And they actually, I think the rule was that they gave me GIF status for 3 years. So I was at the end of my career, and they said it could be retroactive, but I would have 3 years GIF status, and that would allow me to finish my career. And I think the federation then had 14 days to oppose it. So obviously, I didn't think that they were going to oppose it. I probably had every club in the country phoning me. You know, I had all the big coaches, all the big clubs phoning me. You know, we've got GIF status now, and you know, this was fantastic news. And on the 14th day, I got a phone call that the federation had then voted against me, and
it's insane.
Couldn't get hold of any of those coaches that had been phoning me anymore. So it was quite disappointing, and it just showed that the influence that status does have. I mean, if you are GIF, it is definitely a massive pulling point for clubs and stuff, which I understand. And it was one of those things. It was something that I actually, in hindsight, I just wish I'd never taken on. I just carried on playing the way I was going and not get involved in something like it. But like I said, it was brought to me. It wasn't my idea. It was brought to me by people. And obviously, I take responsibility that I looked at the opportunity.
Yeah, but mate, going not pursuing this this whole legal battle to get the GIF status would have meant for you to keep on going with those big clubs, you would have to drop the French team, because that's what you touched on. Basically, imagine a professional coach of Toulouse or whatever. Why would he sign Scott Spilling if he still plays for the French team? So he's away 8, but it's like double punishment. But on top of that, he doesn't count in my quota. Yeah. So you would have had to give him something up in the meantime. I think this whole thing honestly made me very sad, because you got caught up into, like you said, the egos that are the burden of, or have been the burden of, French rugby for years and years and years. This is a conversation that should be behind closed doors between the federation, the league, and this and that. And then I sit down and say, listen, Scotty plays for the French team. Let's sort him out. Not only does he play for the French team, but he's a French citizen. And the legal thing is that basically if Scotty, when he was Espoirs for Brive, refused his first professional contract and actually stayed for the academy 2 more years, then none of this would have ever happened. It's literally signing a piece of paper, yes or no, and the status of the contract. That's all that changed. That's the only difference. But Scotty, remember, the league, when you said that to them, were like, oh, you're trying to kill the whole GIF system as a whole. You're like, hang on, no, I'm not. Yes, because if we allow it to you, then and then your lawyers and everybody actually looked. Yes, there could have been three guys that were possibly could have been in the same status as him. That's not going to make everything, you know, rock their world and this and that. It's purely egos. It's the federation was already at war with league, so they can't work together. So those conversations behind closed doors never happen. And at the end, if they pulled out, because I learned that after, it's because they finally got an agreement with the league regarding something completely different, which was a number of guys that the Guinoves could call up on the French camp. Remember that one, going from 31 to 42? Yeah. And because they got that agreement, they thought, oh, fuck, if we actually back Scotty again, then they're going to say no to it. So it's just because people cannot get their heads out of their asses, get their egos out of their bodies, and actually just look at something for what it is instead of making a whole war out of it. And that does just hit you. So you're a victim of that. It's honestly, it's a sad example of how shit things can be over there.
Yeah, no, it was disappointing. And I actually, in hindsight, I should never have just entertained the thought, eh? But like I said, I was advised by a few people, maybe badly advised. And I mean, Benji, you helped me. I mean, even in the beginning, the Players Association in France was all behind me. You know, they were there. They're going to help me massively. But I think they also received massive pressure.
We spoke about this already. Massive pressure for what? That's what they're there for. They're there to protect you. They're there to help you. That the president, Robin Chalewachu of the Players Association, called Scott. Is like, oh, you know, and then I called him. And he's like, oh, you don't realize the amount of pressure I got. What the fuck do you do? What's your job then? Your job is to take the pressure off Scott. Your job is to be screaming because he put one tweet saying the players are sharing back Scotty. Oh, you don't realize the repercussion of this tweet. What else are you guys meant to do? You know, if you're not there to challenge and to speak up for the players, what is it? And again, it's because they don't work together, and he was scared that they wouldn't get anything else
because they were trying to fight, I think it was like the pension and, you know, there's something to do with the contract structures that they were fighting for the players. Oh, if we fight the league with that, they're not going to give us this. Then kill Scotty, you know, drop one for the other 10 to stay alive. It's sad.
But then I hope, Scotty, for you, like, you haven't gone through it in vain. I hope that the more it's talked about and the more people realize, like, you've gone through a process, it exposes how daft the situation is here with LNR, FFR, even with Proval all being linked financially, how much pressure there is. I hope that ultimately you've gone through it. It has been a process that has been hard, tricky. It hasn't gone the way you wanted. And you now wish you hadn't started it. But the positive that might come out of it is that we might see change. Eventually, if people get hold of the story, they understand how poorly run it is, and how guys like you have been affected, we might see change. So yes, regret, but at the same time, hopefully it's been for something.
Yeah, I do hope so. I do hope that just some common sense prevails in a system like that. You know, I know Bernard Laporte, he wanted to bring a different system into place. He struggled to bring some of his ideas into action. Obviously, he's struggling to get past the league and stuff. But obviously, I also realized that it's not that easy with European law and stuff like that to put something in place that's actually durable. But in an ideal world, what you would like to have is, like Bernard Laporte has said, to play for France now, you need to have a French passport. So really, and I agree with that rule. I think that to play for another country, you should have a passport. You know, the three-year rule, it maybe cheapens a little. Once you've got a passport, you can play for France. Already, you've got that. To have a quota system, I think that you should, one, have citizenship. So you're a French citizen, plus you must be eligible to play for France. Then you should be protected by the quota system. There's no point in having guys protected by your quota system who play for other countries. And so obviously in an ideal world, I know law is difficult, European law. In an ideal world, it should just be citizenship plus eligible to play, you're protected by the system. And that way, the French coach, he's going to have an abundance of players that he can choose from. Because I think that's also where the problems come in. The French coach, even though a guy is Gif, he's a Georgian that plays tight head prop. So it doesn't help his selection criteria now. He still can't choose the guy. So the more eligible guys we can have in the teams, the better the French team's going to get, because you've got more choice, you've got more competition. And I would like to see a rule, some sort of rule come in place like that, where it protects the French team more than it's just enforcing a rule for enforcing a rule.
I couldn't agree more.
And Scott, we've gone through the whole journey from sort of, you know, how passionate, how emotional you were to play for France and to become a French citizen. And then we've talked about how the politics behind the scenes. I just wonder, how much of a sour taste has it left? Because it had a massive impact on the end of your career, and sort of you couldn't get a club, like, essentially from the clubs that were after you before. How much of a sour taste has it left the players' union and the FFR kind of saying they'd back you and then kind of disappearing? And then if as Johnny said, if there is to be a kind of a good solution at the end of this where no one else has to go through this again, it's obviously painful for you, but is that something you'd be up for helping with in the future?
Yeah, for sure. Of course, I'd love to, if I can in any sort of way help progress French rugby, even if it's just by giving my sort of perspective or experience of a system, then I'm all for it. I think we all want to see good French rugby. I think world rugby is poorer for not having a good French team. I think the top 14 is a fantastic competition. I think the teams that I really enjoy top 14, I love the crowds. And so I think just a few things need to get sorted out here. And we all want the same thing in the end of the day. It did leave a bit of a sour taste at the end of my career. I can't deny that. It wasn't the only factor. I could have continued playing. Probably wasn't getting the clubs or the contract that maybe I was after. And, you know, coupled with other things, coupled with I'd lost a lot of motivation, probably because of the process that I'd just gone through. I was just a bit deflated and it probably felt like the right time. I wasn't going to add much value to a team in sort of with the motivation I had and stuff. So I decided that it was a good time for me to probably call it. You know, had I had the GIF status, you know, you would probably be presented with an amazing project, an amazing club, and, you know, obviously the salary that goes with, and then you obviously motivated again. But I had to be honest with myself, because I did have Joe Aldebd, who was the Cust coach at the time, Ford's coach, who went to take on Uyanax, and he wanted me to go with him. He really wanted me to go with him and be a senior player for him. And, you know, but it was his first opportunity as a manager, as a head coach. And like I'd spoken with Storm, my wife, and I was just like, you know, I'm going to let this guy down. He's going to put a lot of hope on me going there because it's his big opportunity now, and I'm going to let the guy down. I need to be honest with him and probably tell him to, you know, put his resources or his energy into getting someone else. I was going to get down on myself. As Benji mentioned, I'm probably my biggest critic, and I wasn't going to play the way I wanted to play. I'm going to disappoint him. I'm going to disappoint myself. And it was the moment that I said, look, all in all, it wasn't just the GIF thing that played a part. It was also the way I was playing, maybe because I'd been affected by things. But it was a group of things that sort of made me, look, this is probably the time to call it. And disappointing that it ended like that. Obviously, it would be great to end. We all love to end with a title or with a big send-off and everything. I didn't get that. But, you know, there's still so many more positives over the 10 or 11, 12-year career that I had in France that I'm extremely proud of and very, 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 very fortunate to have had.
Well, that's incredibly gracious of you to turn down that contract because you didn't think you would add what you might have done. I think a lot of players would have taken that deal and just rode it out and earned the money and gone off and retired that way. But that's the past and the present and the future now, the positive. I know you worked for Supersport, didn't you, on the World Cup last year. So what are you doing now and what does the future hold for Scott Spedding?
Yeah, so I finished in June last year and I decided it was a good idea to finish my studies, something I neglected early on in my early 20s to rather focus on rugby. So I got that done, which was quite a relief. And then a great opportunity to go to Supersport over the World Cup. I went as an analyst to talk about the French team. You know, they had a guy from each country and I went to talk about the French. And it was a great experience. So look, any opportunities I've worked with Johnny on a few games for BT Sport in England, which has been good fun. So it's nice to stay involved in rugby like that. You still get to go to the game, you talk about it, you have to do your research. So that was quite enjoyable. And, you know, we'll see what the future holds. I don't have anything that planned for the moment. But, I'm actually really enjoying life off the rugby. I'm enjoying watching the guys. I'm enjoying playing a lot of golf now and a lot less pressure.
You've got a big project coming up next year, Scott. You'll be out there with the Lions too, will you not?
Yeah, so I'm passionate about the Kruger Park and Safari and stuff like that. So when the opportunity came for me to get to be involved in a lodge in South Africa, you know, we built a lodge in the Kruger Park. And so that's a bit of a passion project, but also a business that we're running at the moment. And then for the Lions tour, we'll take a few groups out. Obviously, you know Mark Phillips very well, played with him in Bayonne, and he'll be out there and he'll be hosting evenings around an open fire with a few drinks and talking, you know, everything rugby and book.
They could get messy those nights.
I was going to say, Serge Blanco's going to catch wind of this, mate. Blanco's going to be out there straight away. He'll sniff it from France.
Now we're looking forward to that. So that'll be fun out there. And probably Mark's he's a great guy to have. You know, he knows how to entertain guys and have a couple of drinks around a fire. So we're looking forward to that. And hopefully the tour goes ahead. We just don't know. Seems to be in limbo at the moment.
Fingers crossed. And you didn't fancy coaching, Scott? No ambitions to move into coaching? Or
look, I'll never say never. I think I would enjoy coaching juniors. And I might go start soon with Bayonne and coaching some of the junior stuff, but more just out of, you know, trying to pass on a bit of knowledge. If I can help any younger, like I needed help. I had guys who helped me as a youngster. And if I can pass it on to anyone and how to go about things, you know, I'd love to do that. I don't think I was ever a great video analyst of rugby. You know, like a guy like Nick Abendanen would watch a video and work out how things sort of came about, and he's very good at analyzing games and opposition. And it was never really something that interested me. I used to hate video sessions, and so I think professional rugby hasn't really been that attractive to me. I'll never say never. Maybe by coaching juniors, I find my own way, but probably not on the radar.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the show, Scott, and sharing your journey from South Africa to France and all the trials and tribulations in between. And good luck with any future media opportunities and also coaching your son and Johnny's son through to the France international team.
Yeah, cool. Thanks for having me, guys. Awesome.
Cheers, Scotty.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers, Scott.
My man.
Legend.
Yeah, an amazing bloke. Absolute legend. And probably the example of how to come to France and do it, ending up being a fully fledged international. And he's a good bloke as well, and he's now properly into his life after rugby. He took me down to the beach, I think, 2 weeks ago. I don't know how many bottles of rosé we got through, but it took me about 2 weeks to recover. So he's certainly enjoying life after rugby. He downplayed that a bit, but great guy, a teammate of yours, Benji, a lovely bloke, and one of the good ones that's done it really, really well coming over.
No, it's good to see him. Look, he was. Not only did he fight with his not mental health, but with his mental side, where he blamed himself all the time. It was so heavy and he could get dark from times. He trained like an animal. I mean, he was the guy who would come in because he think he wasn't fit enough. So he would run, he would do weights, he would do whatever. He was constantly on an edge, not necessarily going out much and trying to be careful. And, you know, he was being very hard on himself. So basically see him, like you said, with a smile on his face, sort of almost philosophical about what happened before and just enjoying life is good to me. It's good to see.
I think he's one of those guys that is better off retired. Like when retirement comes, it's a good thing. Like you get people that really miss it and really battle with not having it. But like you talked again about his battles when he played and how hard he was on himself. Not having that pressure week to week for some people is a good thing. And yeah. Scotty's definitely one. Like I'm not missing it either, but Scotty's one of those guys now you can actually finally relax. You can go and play golf. You can have a glass of wine, have a beer, and life is easier for him now. So no, top bloke, and he's done it the right way. Good man.
Yeah, brilliant to have Scott on. And we won't talk too much about the top 14 this week because we're coming out quite late in the week. But your old club, Johnny Bayonne, had a good win at Stade Francais. I think it was the first time they'd won in Paris for about a decade, wasn't it?
Yeah, more, I think. Also more impressive when you consider the context. So the financial battle that they're up against. So people won't realise, but things are even harder now with COVID. There is so little money, but Bayonne got on the train. They did a 5-hour train journey the day of the game, fell off the train and absolutely blitzed Stade Francais. I mean, you can't play down enough, or you shouldn't play down, sorry, just how big a fight and how big a struggle that is. It was the same. So Bayonne, when we got promotion up to the top 14, we had to bus to Oyonnax for 14 hours the day before a game and then play Oyonnax at 1 o'clock the next day. Like, it's a tough old grind. So the fact that these boys, and there's a special team spirit, they're a good bunch of lads, they work bloody hard, that the fact that they could rock up after a 5-hour train journey and do that, and the manner in which they did it to Stade Francais, they pretty much took them apart, is impressive. So it was good to catch up with a couple of them Monday, Tuesday, just say well done. They were chuffed to bits. Good images coming back in the change room. They had a good laugh as well on the train on the way back down. So well done to them, because that's hugely impressive given the context and the fight that they have financially. A hugely impressive victory for them.
Yeah, it's a big victory. Bayonne looking good on the other side. My old teammates Clermont did a classic. They blew away Agen, but they didn't get the bonus point. And Bordeaux, funnily enough, had a bad loss in Lyon. And it was completely the other way. So Bordeaux and Lyon are basically sort of west, east of France, opposite. And Christophe Rios was like, next time we'll take Amazing. The bus. Because they took a private plane to go. And so they went there. He did a 10-minute speech. If I could translate that one for you, it's like Commedia dell'arte, but French. He's just next level. He takes the piss out of all of them. You know, it was about, you know, if you don't want to play, you won't play. They're going to be burned on the bus. Nah, I'm going to be angry today. A little bit more angry tomorrow. I'll be very angry Wednesday. Now we're going to fuck that. No GPS this week. No GPS. You can forget about that. We're going to go balls. Yes, I want contact, you know. So he was sort of playing that thing. He's a bit of a character, Christophe Rios, I have to say, but completely on the other side of the spectrum. So basically, they're going to go back to the roots and do follow Bayonne's example, bus it, train it, whatever it is, but no more private planes.
If you're a French speaker, that YouTube clip of his is post-match press conference. He's already got 750,000 hits. If you can speak French, go and watch it. He's awesome. He's a great orator, like having worked with him. He's a funny guy as well. But go and watch the clip. If you can speak French, it's well worth watching.
It's like 12 minutes long. There's probably two questions. You don't need to ask him anything.
It's a monologue.
Just let me go. You know, it's a rant about it. Am I happy? Ooh, that is funny. Very French, very funny.
And international rugby coming up as well. So Fabien Galthié is named his France squad this week, hasn't he? So what have you made of it? And one question I had, I'm sure you'll talk about who's in and who's not, but Mohamed Hawass, are you surprised that he's in? Because we sort of spoke about his issues off the field.
No, I'm not surprised, to be fair. So he led the team down massively against Scotland by punching a dude and getting a red card. He should have not done that. What happened in Montpellier, without going into the secrets of everyone, is not the end of the world. He got caught up into, well, he behaved with a couple of teammates like he should have not done. Okay. Since then, he's back on the pitch. He's playing well. So I think the issue is behind. What they meant to say is that you're playing your cards now, so you better behave. I don't think there was many surprise in that French squad other than, well, Damien Penaud was out for 2 months. He sort of, you know, the ligament at the base of your tibia fibulaire, I don't know how you call that. But he's out for 2 months, so he's going to be a big miss. For those who've seen the semi-final, or the quarter-final and the semi-final of Champions Cup of Racing, they discovered a beast of a man playing tight end called Colombe, and he's only 22. I think he's a 1.95 meter or 135 kgs, just an absolute unit, born and bred in Paris. And he got picked up in that squad, so that's a big prospect, or I don't know. They do tend to call some guys that will learn the environment, learn what it is to be part of that squad and all that. And then to touch back on the whole fight between the league and the federation, the league kicked out a fuss because they were fed up of having 42 guys called up. So now we're back to 31. So it lasted, that unity lasted 3 months. And then pandemic arrived, and then we're back to square one. And there's only 31 guys who got picked. But no, good, obviously good side. You still have the, when I see Entamac Jalibert at 10, when I see Dupont-Sorin at 9, when I see Olivon, who's playing really well, Tao, who's playing really well, the second row, I see that Colombe coming back. There's some exciting talent, Vakatawa, Teddy Thomas back in after only, what, one or two games or something like that. Yep. There's still a hell of a lot of talent, and I can't wait to see them again.
And even some of the guys left out that we haven't really, like Macalou at Stade Francais, who's been unbelievable since the start.
Actually, they had to say it because otherwise it was such a surprise for not having him.
I mean, he's been frightfully good. So he was one guy I was hoping would be picked up in the squad. I hope he gets some game time later on, because it's been almost three, four years that he hasn't figured. But I thought this year might be his chance to get in, and his form has been exceptional. So for him. And yet Colombe, again, the big talking point in France is this new tight head. And tight head's not an area that France have struggled, but since, you know, the era of Nicolas Mas and absolute French scrummaging domination, there hasn't been a real pillar of light on the French tight head. And watching this guy coming through, I remember watching him for the under-20s for the French side, and he was an absolute monster, and he's made that step up really quickly. First choice now at Racing, and I really hope he could be maybe the next step for the French side and some renewed French scrum domination. So he's got a couple of huge weeks coming up, again, before we get to the internationals with the final, which hopefully we played. Racing have got zero cases, so fingers crossed for them. But he's been my biggest guy. I've been a fan of him since the start of the year, and caught him under 20. He's been exceptional. Other guys kind of unlucky to miss out. So Clemenzac from Racing has come in at centre, whereas I thought maybe Tozan from Toulouse might have had the nod. He's been freaky again since he got his first game time last year with the Espoirs at Toulouse, and then first top 14 games last year. He's been exceptional as well. And it's more, you talked about Teddy Thomas coming back in, but when you take Damien Penaud out of this French side, you know, we talk about French flair and the running rugby that we like to see. That's the one, not area of fragility, but it's the lightest area for me, is the back three. So if you look at, you know, you've got Vincent Rattez, you've got Ramos and Boutier playing fullback, but there's not the sort of dominance that we're used to seeing. And whether it's with Huger or Penaud, these guys for me are slightly different.
I agree with you, Johnny, but to be fair, who knew Boutier and Rattez 10 months ago? And then now everybody in England knows them because they absolutely killed England for the first game of Six Nations. So I agree with you. It's not sort of the name power, but I mean, the results are there. And you got to give one thing to Galtier. They picked guys that delivered, the Boutier, the Awas, the Rattez, the Arthur Vincent, you know, the center, Olivon, captain, whatever. And they just keep them there. It's not about the name. It's about how you perform.
Well, they will look forward to working with Fabien Galtier and being well drilled by Sean Edwards in the weeks to come. And we'll look forward to talking about it some more, because it's not far away, the end of the Six Nations finally, and then the Autumn Nations Cup. So we will be chatting more international rugby in the coming weeks as well. Thanks, Johnny. Thanks, Benji. And thanks to all of you guys for listening as well. Make sure you hit subscribe, leave us a review, drop us a message on social media, and we will be back with you with another episode next week. Au revoir, guys.
Cheers, guys.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.